Welcome to episode 414 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with book critic, writer, professor, among other things, David Yulin. We discuss the art of criticism, the lost art of reading. Being a book critic at the LA Times, reading as a form of resistance. We also discuss a bit about meeting Lawrence Ferlinghetti and how the great beat poet encouraged literary community. And we discuss greater access for more folks to publish their work. A grand conversation with David Yulin this week. We have an EW essay titled Stardust, and our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, shares an original radio play titled The Shut-In's Bitter Cousin Mary Stops By. We have a poem called Place. All of this will be imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 414 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. Stardust. There are a pair of sneakers on my back brown deck that are tan with an orange stripe. A worker man brought them together with his hand and put them next to one another on top of the base cast iron umbrella stand, the left one slightly tilted to the center of the circumference, within which the two are secure and waiting to be worn again, I suppose. I mean, what other purpose might they have in my perception? Anthropomorphism is sort of an unintentional hobby. I look outside from the inside on a bright day, hoping from an upside. On a dark day, influenced by the downside, everything revolving around me. How within this narrow yet creative quagmire can one be free? Excuse me while I kiss the sky, fluttering like a butterfly, stung like a bee. Oh, it had to be me, wonderful me. Those sneakers have been on the deck since autumn, through a long snowy winter, askew and buried, untethered and misconstrued as lost, forgotten forever. Until one sun-filled spring day, a worker man replacing the house's siding brought them back together again, the left foot on the left and the right foot on the right, placed ever so poignantly along the nucleus of the cast iron circle that soon will hold steady again a big striped umbrella, allowing one and more to sit under it, protected from the white strong light projecting us home from way out there in the Milky Way. And my heart lifts a bit, and my spirit with it sings hip, hip, hooray, at least for a few moments today.
Sunshine came softly through my window today. I could have tripped out easy, but I changed my ways. It'll take time, I know. But in a while, you're gonna be mine, I know it. We do it in style, 'cause I made my mind up. You're going to be mine. I'll pick up your hand, I'll pick up your hand, and slowly blow your little mind.
Take up your hand and slowly blow your little.
Hello, David Yulin, is that you?
It is me, yes. Is Lawrence?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get started, let's share a little background information with the listeners.
Okay.
David L. Yulin is Associate Professor of the Practice of English at the University of Southern California. He is the author or editor of a dozen books, including Sidewalking, Coming to Terms with Los Angeles, which was shortlisted for the Penn Diamondstein Spielvogel Award for the Art of the Essay, and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, which won a California Book Award, as well as The Lost Art of Reading, Books and Resistance in a Troubled Time. The former book editor and book critic of the Los Angeles Times, he has also written for The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, The New Yorker, The Nation, The New York Times, Book Forum, The Paris Review, Columbia Journalism Review, and National Public Radio's All Things Considered. David has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, Black Mountain Institute, and the Lennon Foundation. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is very happy to have on the program David Yulin. Again, thank you. Thank you for taking the time out, Professor.
My pleasure.
I want to help people understand, how they might become a book critic and an editor. How did you get to where you are? How did you end up where you are today?
It was a combination of, I think, serendipity, a little bit of intention, stubbornness, and an inability to do anything else. I always wanted to be a writer, even as a young kid. Once I learned or realized that books were something that got made in the world, that they didn't just sort of magically exist, that could be your job to kind of make books. I wanted to do that. I was a very avid reader from the age of about 5 or 6, and books were kind of center to my world. And so the idea of being able to participate in that somehow, that conversation, I don't think I would have framed it that way as a little kid, but that conversation to be kind of on the shelf with the writers who were kind of opening up the world to me, seemed like the obvious thing, that the only thing I really, really wanted to do. I had no idea that it was difficult or that it was something that many people didn't do. And so I became, first a kind of baby writer in junior high and high school, writing stories and things like that. And then in college, I was an English major. I wrote a novel as a senior thesis, not a particularly good novel, but it did teach me a lot of things about kind of what to do and what not to do in terms of and also just sort of the commitment required to write a book. And then when I got out of college, I was raised in New York. I went back to New York. I got a job in a bookstore and, met some other writers. And at one point, one of them said to me, I know you want to get published. You read a lot. You're an English major. You know how to critique work. You should try writing book reviews. This was in the 1980s when that was actually a viable, low-end but viable profession. And so I wrote a couple of sample book reviews and sent them out, and ended up first getting an unpaid job with a very small Arts Monthly in New York, where I kind of put together the book coverage. And what I discovered, much to my surprise, because I'd never had any experience with it, was that I really liked the immediacy of journalism and kind of public criticism. I liked that conversational aspect. I was thinking more consciously about it at that point. And I liked the idea that I was commenting on stuff as it was coming out and readers were reading it. We were part of a kind of a heightened version of the conversation I was having with my friends anyway, as new books we wanted to read came out. The immediacy of it, and also in some way the disposability of it, because in the so-called literary projects, and I just want to interject here to say that I don't make that distinction anymore at this point, but when I was in my 20s, I did, were the literary projects, the novel I was working on was so, long-term, that there was something really vivid to me about the immediacy of writing a review and putting it out into the world and having it come and go really quickly. It took the pressure off in a certain sense, which I was then able to kind of transfer over to my other writing. And then it's a long sort of twisted road of sort of serendipity and various opportunities and things like that. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that I never, I don't know. It wasn't that I didn't take no for an answer, but it never occurred. There was nothing else for me to do. I only know how to do this. I'm fairly unskilled in virtually every other aspect of my life. So in a lot of ways too, it was kind of, it was a matter of necessity.
Yeah. Necessity for sure. But I mean, you are definitely talented. It doesn't just, perseverance is important, but of course you're being humble. You have a talent for certain. And I want to commend that, but I want to ask you, how do you respond to people that often say, you know, oh, critics, you were a critic for the, you've done writing work as a critic for the Los Angeles Times. When people say, oh, critics are the worst, how do you respond to that?
Sometimes they're right. You know, I think it depends on your approach to criticism. I mean, I think critics, There are good and bad critics out there, and I think we can define them in a variety of different ways. For me, the primary thing was a critic with a grudge, or a critic with a chip on their shoulder, or a particular kind of axe to grind. I don't want to just say any axe, because I think all good critics have a kind of critical axe, or an aesthetic axe to grind, or an aesthetic point of view that they are writing from and that they are reading from. And I know that that's true in other arts as well. And I think that aesthetic sensibility, or that sense of, let's say, for want of a better phrase, that sense of taste, I don't mean it in like a high or low taste, but what their taste is really important, because it's necessary for us to understand that criticism is subjective, just like all arts are. And there is no objective standard or at least from my mind, there is no objective standard of what makes a book good or makes a book not good. It really has to do with how that book hits you as a reader first, and then as a critic, as you're thinking your way through it. So I think it's, you know, so for me, the idea though was that I think critics, like all writers, need to be outward looking. You're writing your own take on a book. You're writing your own sort of response to it. You have to be honest in the first place, because your responsibility is to the work that you're doing and also to your reader. So if the book isn't working for you, you have to know how to say that. But I think for me the issue was always, I never wanted to relish writing a negative review. I never, you know, I wrote them. I still do when they're called for, when I feel they're called for, when I have that response to a book. But I never wanted to go in with that agenda. I've always been a critic who, you know, approaches books because I want to read them. And then if it turns out that I'm disappointed by the book, or the book has problems, then I kind of write out of that sense of sort of I think at one point I called it disappointed love. and so I think that sense of empathy for the writer and for the work is necessary. If you're just a literary hitman, that's a whole other story. And I never liked those kind of reviews. Reading them, I tried never to write those kind of reviews. As an editor, I went out of my way never to assign or publish those kind of reviews, because I think that they diminish the conversation rather than open up the conversation. And for me, the critic's prime role is to be a kind of, I don't want to say a facilitator of the conversation, but to participate in a three-part conversation between the work under review, then the critic and their sensibility, and then the reader who's reading that review. I think it's a really complicated dynamic, and the critics I most respect are aware of that in their writing.
Wonderfully put. Thank you for that insight. And, you know, I look at your title as professor at USC, and I want to ask you about that too. You're a professor of the practice of English. What exactly does that mean?
It means that basically I got hired because of my professional experience, not because of my academic standing. I don't have a graduate degree. I got a BA, and then went, as I said, when I went up back to New York to after I got out of college, work. And so there's a category of professor who they, you know, particularly in English department, well, in our case, because the English department also has a strong creative writing focus, writers who, because of their professional practice, are hired to come and talk to students with that sort of as their standard of expertise. So that's the category. That's my category.
I like that.
I actually love it, because I like the idea of practice, of artistic practice, and I do think of it that way. And I like the idea of practitioner. I think that's a great thing to be.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Thank you. Thank you for clarifying. I thought it was a great turn of phrase in a way, the practice of English. So I wanted to get some more information. Now, yeah. Your book on the lost art of reading. I mentioned it when we were sharing a little bit about your background. The Lost Art of Reading: Books and Resistance in a Troubled Time. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Why did you feel the need to write it, and what is it about?
Well, it's an interesting. I mean, it sort of ties into what we've been talking about. When I was before I was book critic at the LA Times, I was book editor. I edited the book section there from 2005 to 2010, and beginning around 2008, it definitely had to do with the election and sort of my kind of obsessive interest in the election. But it also had to do with the fact that I had never had high speed internet until 2008. But the combination of all of those elements, and then and also the sort of going, I don't want to say pressure of running that section. There was certainly pressure in running that section, but it was really fun. But there was a ton of communications to field, as you can imagine, right? Ton of emails from publishers and publicists and writers and pitches and, you know, meetings with people about the section and the paper. And what I found was that the combination of all of these things, a sort of, you know, the constantly being on the internet, checking the election stuff, things were speeding up at that point. It was the very beginning of social media. Blogs were in their heyday. And we were learning to think in terms of digital time rather than print time. It felt like I was so constant. There was such a kind of tumult always. There was so much noise. So many emails to answer, so many meetings to go to, so many assignments to make, so much of this, that I found that I was having enormous difficulty being able to like quiet my mind enough to concentrate and read. I would read five pages of something and then I'd be like, oh, I better check my email and see what's going on or what's happening in the campaign today or any of those kind of things. And I started observing, and it was upsetting to me because has always been the kind of lens through which I make sense of the world, my place within the world. So I started thinking about what this meant. Also, I was editing a book section, and it felt like, you know, almost professional malpractice to be the editor of a book review section and not actually be able to finish a book. I had a really excellent editor there at the LA Times who worked on the book review staff, who edited my stuff. An editor named Orly Lowe, who's a really magnificent editor. And I was talking to her about this, and she said, you should write an essay about that. And I said, how can I possibly write an essay about that? It'd be like publicly resigning from my job. And she said, no, I think that if it's happening to you, who does this for a living, it's probably happening to a lot of other readers as well. This is also the beginning of e-books and, as I said, the kind of transition to digital. And, you know, it's probably happening to other readers as well, and they might find it reassuring to hear that they're not alone. So with Orly as my editor, I first spent a month or so working on an essay for the LA Times about this, and the essay was called The Lost Art of Reading. That came out in the summer of 2009, and it was, and she was right. I mean, I got more response to that piece than almost any piece I ever published in the newspaper, and almost all of it was, thank you. I feel the same. I got that from writers. I got that from readers. I got that from professors. I got that from all sorts of people. And so there's a press, the press that ended up publishing the book, Sasquatch Books, which is in Seattle. Their editor and publisher contact Gary Lewis and said, I'm interested in this piece. Is there anything I'd be interested in? Are you interested in expanding it into a book? And I thought at first, I said, I don't know that I am. I think I've said everything I need to say about this. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, there's a book I really love by a writer named Lynn Sharon Schwartz called Ruined by Reading. And it's sort of a memoir of her reading life. And I always had kind of wanted to write one of those. And so the more I thought about it, the more I thought that it could be a kind of hybrid book that could have, and I like hybrid books, so that began to be really interesting to me. It could have a kind of element of a reader's memoir to it, while also having a series of kind of reflections on kind of where we were in the culture at that point and what it meant that we were making this transition. People were talking about how books were going to be gone, how reading was dying. I didn't believe any of that was true. But then, of course, there was my own difficulty in reading. And then in the middle of it, my son, who is not a reader, by any stretch, but who was in ninth grade at the time, was assigned to read The Great Gatsby, and he was having a lot of trouble, not with Gatsby itself, but his English teacher had asked them to do annotations, and he kept saying to me, like, I just want to read the book. I keep having to pull out of the book to take these notes. So I sort of, without that, I said to him, I'll read it with you. And he was like, no, don't do that. So I started reading Gatsby with him. And then that became, my rereading of Gatsby and his resistance at 15 to having his father be like, let's talk about Gatsby, became a kind of part of the narrative driver, that became a narrative driver for the book. So all of a sudden, there were all of these sort of elements in play. And that's always what I like about writing. That's how I know a project's working. If I start with one thing in mind, then all of a sudden I realize there's this and this and this and this that all can kind of be brought in. And at that point, I'm dealing with a much bigger, more complicated idea than I thought I had. That's how that's where I get really interested. And so that's what ended up happening. And I ended up, writing that book and publishing it in 2010. And then at the end of the book, there's a line about reading as a kind of quiet resistance or quiet form of resistance, a way of pulling back from the kind of flash of the culture. Post 2016, post the presidential election, the publisher contacted me and said, do you want to update the book and do a second edition? And so we ended up going back and forth about that and deciding to do it and connecting that question of reading and a kind of the sort of critical thinking of reading as a kind of resistance factor in a culture that had seemed to be going off the rails, and particularly in terms of kind of critical analysis or the ability to hold a cohesive or coherent narrative in one's head. So that was where the second edition came from.
Excellent. Thank you. And that was definitely necessary and needed, and hopefully now, given I would like to think we're in a new era politically, to a certain extent, that maybe critical thinking will be cherished and exercised a bit more. But your book,
I would like to think that too.
Yeah, let's hope. Now the pandemic. Has it helped then, would you say, with reading, do you think?
I mean, I can only speak really from my own perspective. And for me, it's been a mixed bag. The first few months of the pandemic, reading was really, really difficult. I found concentrating on pretty much anything was really difficult because the outside circumstances were so uncertain and so constantly changing and so dangerous that I, at least for me, my imaginative sensibilities were caught up in what does it mean to survive? What is it we're surviving into if in fact we survive? And it took a while for it to settle for me, probably until middle of the summer. And partly that had to do with the fact that, I think I just got accustomed a little bit to what this pandemic life was like. Also, towards the end of the summer, cases in Los Angeles were on the decline. So it felt, there was some guarded, I don't want to say optimism exactly, but it didn't feel as hopeless. So I was able to concentrate on other things. And so, in the early part of the pandemic, I wasn't reading much, or if I was, I was reading sort of small essays and things like that, mostly about people's experiences in the pandemic. I wasn't writing all that much either, except for those same kinds of pieces. And then in, mid, late summer, like July or thereabouts, I started both reading more and really kind of immersing in reading more, just because it was great to be pulled out and put into a different world, among other things. I don't want to minimize the escapist value of reading. But I also began writing more comprehensively, or writing more, I don't want to say more deeply, but writing longer things and writing more consistently, I guess, is how I would put it. And that has continued through wherever we are now. Who knows? Right now, as I say, right now, knock on wood, things look okay in Los Angeles, but it's a fluid situation.
It surely is, no doubt, variants and all.
You're listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure. on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Now, let's talk a little bit about someone who lives in the same state as you, or lived in the same state as you, passed recently, one of the greats, beat poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Did you ever cross paths with him? Did you go to his bookstore, for example, up in San Francisco? What do you think of his passing?
I did. I mean, I knew Lawrence. I didn't know him well, but I knew him a bit. He, City Lights published my second book, Another City, and I had met him. I'd met him a number of times over the years and talked to him in various, you know, at various events or various social gatherings and things like that. And I did live in San Francisco in a long time. I lived in San Francisco in 1980 and then went back east and went to school and then came back to California about 11 years later. But when I lived in San Francisco, I went to City Lights all the time, and it's always been a touchstone place for me. Whenever I'm in the city, even if I'm in the city for an afternoon, I always make a little bit of time to just walk through the bookstore, because it's a real kind of home in that sense. I think that, you know, what he did there, you know, he taught me a lot. As an example, you know, his sense that a writer could be a writer. I mean, you know, remember he ended up publishing something like 50 books in the course of his lifetime, and also was a painter and an artist. But the idea that a writer could be a writer and could devote oneself to that writerly practice, but could also be a champion for other writers, a champion for literary community, an editor, could create a kind of aesthetic or a vision that was bigger than just one's own, was deeply, deeply influential to me. And I think is one of the, you know, what he's one of, or his example, I should say, is one of the reasons that I have done a lot of the work that I've done. I think a lot of my work as an editor, a lot of my work as a teacher, a lot of my work with, you know, organizations like Penn, in terms of kind of developing literary community or encouraging literary community, I think he, you know, its roots are in Ferlinghetti's example. He was the first person I knew of who did all those things, and who was committed to doing all of those things, and was committed to writing as a public act. And I think also he was a kind of moral example, or a moral avatar in a certain sense too, because he always held the line. He, you know, I mean, he was the one who said, you know, he said he never applied for an NEA grant, as an example, because, as he said, you know, to collaborate with a corrupt society makes you, or a corrupt government makes you complicit. And, you know, I don't know that I wouldn't necessarily go that far. I've certainly applied for an NEA grant. But I love the fact that he was willing to stand up for it, and that it wasn't just kind of bluster when he was on the outside, and he was able to, when he could have been an insider, he didn't turn his back on that. I thought that his integrity, particularly around, I mean, his integrity as an artist, but also his integrity around the question of culture, was a really important, it was really important. And for me, it was really important because it taught me something about how to carry myself. I will always be grateful to him for that.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, David. Talking to David Ulin here on Troubadours and Rock On Tours. And, you know, we're almost there. You know, the conversation goes so quickly. I want to give you an opportunity to maybe reflect a bit on where you think publishing is going. What are some of the hopeful or maybe not so hopeful trends you're seeing? And also, what's coming up for you? What kind of projects are you working on?
Well, I mean, I'll start with the latter question, because then I can build to the, we can talk about the other. I almost never talk about work in progress. So what I will say is, you know, my current project, I'm currently editing a literary journal out of USC called Airlight. It's a hybrid of it's a quarterly, but it's a digital quarterly. So we set up issues and announce issues at the beginning of the quarter, and then we roll out a couple of pieces a week over the course of the 3 months. We're just about done with our second issue. And so that has been a blast. I've always loved, I've always loved editing as a kind of creative act, the art of editing. And again, it's a way for that kind of community that I was talking about, that kind of commitment to other writers to exist, to create a space where artists and writers can do the work that they want to do without commercial pressure, without without even our expectation. Our entire aesthetic in that magazine is, you know, bring us the work you want to bring us. If it doesn't work for us, we won't use it. But don't feel like you have to tailor anything for us. We want to see what you want to bring us. So that's been really fun. We've been doing that. We launched in October, and so that's an ongoing project. I also have just finished a draft of a new book, which is all off. Which needs some revision, but it seems to be hanging together okay. So that, you never know. I tend to write and kind of edit a little bit as I go along, but I like to get the draft done and then do the revision. So it's always a challenging moment or a kind of trepidatious old draft for the first time. So I've just had that experience. As far as publishing, I think that we are in a really interesting and potentially transformative moment in publishing. In terms of the kind of the voices that are I don't want to say that are emerging, they've always been there, but finally publishing or certain, you know, mainstream publishing is paying attention. In terms of the voices that are getting exposure, in terms of the narratives that are getting exposure, in terms of the kind of broad sort of range of styles and forms and artists, I think it's an incredibly exciting time. I think it's really, you know, one of the things that interests me as a writer and as a reader and as an editor, which I think we're seeing now is a time of kind of genre blurring and sort of stepping outside of the lines a little bit, which I think is really important for literature to continue to develop and grow. I think we are finally perhaps starting to move towards some kind of equity in terms of who has access or who gets that. We're not there yet. We're not even close, but we're finally talking about it in terms of race, in terms of orientation, in terms of cultural background, all of it. I think we're in a territory where the landscape of literature in general and American literature particularly feels wide open and kind of incredibly explosive in a very, very exciting way. I see books all the time I'm looking at a stack of books right now that's about 3 feet tall that are all books that I would, you know, that are out or coming out in the next couple of months that I want to read. So I feel like we're in a moment of amazing potential for literature, and I am really eager to kind of see how it develops.
Excellent. Very exciting. David Ulin, book critic, writer, professor at USC, among other things. I have to say, I've read a number of your pieces. I read a lot of the magazines that you write for, and I really appreciate your work, sir, and I appreciate you spending some time with us here on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. All the best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your attention to the work, and I appreciate the interview.
Take care.
You too.
It was sad. the shut-in's bitter cousin Mary stops by. My bitter cousin Mary stopped by the other day to inquire about my mother, who now lives in Skagway, Alaska, with her lover Ronald, a shaman. Mary lives next door, but we rarely see or speak to one another. "How's Aunt Evelyn?" Mary asked, leaning against the doorway and peeking into the living room. Mary is an inveterate peeker. "Always peeking, that's Mary." I shifted my body to obstruct her view. "Oh, you know Evelyn, Mary. From the letters and cards, she seems to be doing well." "She's in love, huh?" Is the mailman sharing the contents of the postcards with Mary, I wonder? I didn't answer. "How about you? How are you doing?" I can count on one hand the number of times Mary asked me that. I leaned toward her a little, and she leaned back a little. I caught a faint whiff of a stiff Bloody Mary. It was mid-morning. She must have just had her breakfast. Mary and her Bloody Marys. "I'm doing as well as can be expected," I said. "Miss her?" "Sure." "Don't you miss your mother?" "My mother's dead," Mary replied. "And mine's in Alaska." Mary chortled, and I chortled back. And for an instant, we bonded in a way we hadn't since we were children. I loved Mary's mother, Big Mary. When she was young, Bitter Mary was Little Mary, always overshadowed and engulfed by Big Mary. Her mother was a big woman with a big personality, a hoot. Ruddy, loud, gregarious, funny, she brightened every room she entered, as they say, surely lying, in so many obituaries. She didn't brighten Mary's room, however. With her daughter, her only child, she was a different Big Mary, snappish, sometimes cruel, sometimes cold, often critical, of Little Mary's dress, Little Mary's refrigerator art, Little Mary's posture. Never enough, never the best, as Big Mary regularly noted in her deep, cigarette, and whiskey-roughened voice. To me, Big Mary was warm and kind, much warmer than my mother, her late husband's sister. And at the corner bar, her social club, Big Mary shined, sharing dirty jokes with old Joe, the bartender, and entertaining the regulars from the neighborhood. Little Mary and little me would come in through the ladies' entrance and sit unobtrusively in the corner with our Shirley Temples and our cheese nips and listen to Big Mary cracking wise about the events of the day and doing her impersonations of Paul Lind and Phyllis Diller. She would down Manhattan after Manhattan, smoke Kent after Kent, and tuck into a plate of ham and potatoes made especially for her by old Joe. Big Mary would hold court on her bar stool and occasionally bring us children into the conversation. "Your father," she would say to little Mary, "was a weak man and none too bright, even considering the men in this family, a pathetic lot." Little Mary's eyes welled at the thought of her maligned father, and Big Mary felt a rare twinge of regret. "Ah," she sighed, torn between sympathy for her sensitive daughter and disgust for all men. She died in her early 50s, the willing victim of too much ham and too many Manhattans. So Big Mary died, and Little Mary became simply Mary, and then, to me, Bitter Mary. Mary did a brief stint at a local community college, got a job as a bank teller, and never left the bank. She was an institution at her little window, known for her accuracy and speed, if not her friendliness. She had a series of suitors of dubious character and unsettled sexuality. When one of those suitors made the lame request, "Can we still be friends?" Mary answered with an emphatic no. And no ultimately became her byword. No to him, no to her, no to this, no to that. No, no, no. Big Mary said yes. Yes to another Manhattan. Yes to another cigarette. Yes to another helping of ham and cabbage. And, now and then, yes to the barfly leering at her from the jukebox. As my bitter cousin Mary stood on my porch, I tried to discern Big Mary in her features, but I couldn't see the mother in the daughter. Buried, perhaps, under all those years of loneliness, all those days at her little window, all those disappointing men. When she realized she wasn't getting any juicy intel about me, from me about my own problematic and wayfaring mother, Mary forced a smile and headed back to her house. I thought of calling out to her, but, as always, refrained.
I'm hoping. that you come back to me. I'm walking, yes indeed, I'm talking about you and me. I'm hoping that you come back to me. What you gonna do when the well runs dry? Are you gonna run away?
Place. The smell of late March, early April toward May and June, the echo of tobacco juice spit and off the inside copper of an old dented spittoon. As I sit on the porch of Migsy and Mang's place, waiting for my bundle of newspapers to arrive, to be folded in the special way that I learned, and arranged in my bag over my shoulder, off the porch, on to the sidewalks, then thrown on the stoops of my neighborhood all those years ago.
After all the jets are in the boxes, and the clowns have all gone to bed. You can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers merry. A broom is drearily sweeping up the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping. Somewhere a king has no wife. And the wind, it cries very.
And there you have it, episode 414 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, David Ulin, our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, and these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, The Beatles, Dr. Lonnie Smith and Iggy Pop, Modu Maktor, the Rebirth Brass Band, Jimi Hendrix, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard II. And of course, I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.